From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. How are you today? I'm Ira Melman.
Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson. On today's program, the crash of an airplane in a busy neighborhood outside Taipei kills at least 25 people. It leaves nearly 20 others missing in shallow water.
Jordan's king vows to take tough action against Islamic State militants following that group's gruesome killing of a Jordanian pilot.
China makes a move in an attempt to prod banks to make more loans to boost the country's weakening economy.
Perceptions of China in the West is the topic of a book whose author speaks with Jim on Authors on Asia.
In the American Cafe, a story of prison inmates making a difference in the environment.
And David Byrd will be here with Now, taking a look at a new science fiction film.
We'll check business and sports as well. It's all coming up on today's edition of VOA Global from the Voice of America.
It's
glad to
good.
Have you with us.
It's all good.
It's all good. Hello, glad to have you with us for Daybreak Asia, our summary of Asian news and events for Thursday, February 5th. I'm Jim Stevenson. In brief today, authorities in Taiwan launched operations to try and rescue survivors from a Trans-Asia passenger plane that had 58 people on board when it crashed shortly after takeoff from an airport in downtown Taipei. There have been many fatalities, and Ralph Jennings has more for VOA from Taipei, where dramatic video footage captured the plane's rapid descent and crash landing into the shallow Keelung River.
An ATR-72 prop passenger jet operated by Taiwan-based TransAsia Airways crashed Wednesday morning shortly after takeoff from an airport near downtown Taipei after clipping a bridge and hurtling sideways into a river. The flight with 58 people aboard was on its way to a domestic airport in the outlying Jinmen Islands. Officials say at least 31 of the passengers were tourists from mainland China. National defense and fire rescue crews on rubber rafts extricated people from the door of the plane's mostly submerged fuselage and took survivors to local hospitals. Another ATR-72 aircraft operated by the same airline crashed in the Taiwan-controlled Penghu Islands last July, killing 48 people. TransAsia Chief Executive Officer Peter Chen told reporters he did not know why the plane went down. He says the age of the plane had not reached even 1 year, and it had undergone scheduled maintenance on the 26th of last month. He says the airline hereby apologizes deeply, and then it will do its utmost to help the injured and families of the victims, doing all it can to mobilize people to do work in the crash aftermath. The 63-year-old airline had a clean safety record before last July, but is now likely to face tougher public scrutiny along with the European aircraft manufacturer. An official with the Civil Aeronautics Administration said the flight lost contact with air control at central Taipei's Songshan Airport at 2 minutes after takeoff. Video captured along with the heavily used freeway next to the crash site show the plane flying sideways as it rapidly lost altitude before hitting a taxi on an elevated freeway in its final seconds in the air. The taxi driver was mildly injured. Some 165 National Defense personnel and fire rescue crews scrambled to pull survivors and bodies from the wreckage. The Aviation Administration will begin a formal investigation into the crash. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
Japan's role on the world stage has been brought into sharp focus by the executions of two Japanese nationals by the Islamic State terror group in Syria. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe wants to change the country's pacifist stance and take a more proactive role in global security. However, many Japanese disagree. For VOA, we hear more now from Henry Ridgewell.
On the streets of Tokyo, there is much uncertainty about how their country should react to the murders of Kenji Goto and Haruna Yukawa by the terror group Islamic State. Student Ryo Murata says that it happened in a place far away from Japan, but the victims are Japanese. It's terrible that they were killed in such a place, she says. Fellow student Kyosuke Kamogawa says he is scared. The militants were saying they will start to target Japanese citizens from now on. That sends chills down my spine, he adds. Japan's first challenge is facing the terror threat posed by the Islamic State, says John Swenson Wright, head of the Asia program at policy group Chatham House.
Are they going to retreat into a position of relative isolation in the face of the shock that this execution represents? Or are they going to accept the logic that Japan is inevitably embroiled in international affairs in a way that doesn't allow it to take that low-profile position.
Islamic State says it targeted the Japanese hostages because Tokyo offered $200 million in non-military aid to countries fighting the terror group. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was forthright in his response to the executions. Mr. Abe said that Japan will cooperate with the international community to make Islamic State atone for their crimes. Japan will never yield to terrorism. His determination to engage in the fight could be costly, says Professor Koichi Nakano of Sophia University in Tokyo.
There are people who blame Abe for having brought the crisis in the first place, while there are others who agree with Abe and argue that this is why Japan should do more in the fight against terrorism.
Currently, Japan's post-war constitution bars its armed forces from participating in conflicts overseas. In the wake of the beheadings, Prime Minister Abe is seeking changes to allow self-defense forces to rescue Japanese citizens abroad. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
During U.S. President Barack Obama's recent visit to India, he and Indian leaders committed to work more closely to promote stability and peace in the Asia-Pacific and Indian Ocean regions. But even as New Delhi makes a significant shift in aligning itself with Washington to contain China's growing influence, it is also working to smooth ties with its Asian neighbor. Anjana Pasricha has been following the story closely in New Delhi.
As Indian Foreign Minister Sushma Swaraj visited Beijing this week, Indian and Chinese leaders struck an optimistic note about growing the relationship between the two nations. Chinese officials backed India's bid for a permanent seat on the UN Security Council, as well as an Indian proposal for a resolution in the world body to punish countries that shelter and finance terrorism, widely seen as a measure that could target Pakistan. The visit was seen as an effort to reassure Beijing after India and the United States forged what is being called a new alliance to counter China's growing assertiveness in the region. During President Barack Obama's recent visit to New Delhi, he and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi declared an era of new trust. In a joint strategic vision, they pledged to work together to protect freedom of navigation, maintain maritime security, and keep airspace safe in the Asia-Pacific and Indian Ocean region. It was a significant departure for India, which has stayed away from explicitly aligning its security concerns with Washington. Lalit Mansingh, the former Indian Foreign Secretary and Ambassador to the United States, says India has virtually abandoned its policy of non-alignment.
China is not directly mentioned, but there is a perception amongst the diplomats and the strategic planners that in the long term, China poses a threat. And therefore, we see a greater convergence of Mr. Modi's Act East policy and President Obama's rebalance in Asia. So from all these points of view, I think the U.S. is emerging as the principal strategic partner of India.
Analysts say the challenge for India in the months ahead will be to grow its friendship with Washington while not alienating Beijing. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. Stop by voanews.com for longer versions of these stories. Many have great photos and video. And while you're there, subscribe to our free Daybreak Asia podcast.
We hear from you during the audience feedback section. That is this right here on VOA Global with Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. Here's the story. North Korea is dismissing the possibility of renewing talks with the United States, which it said is trying to overthrow the communist government in Pyongyang. Well, Captain Courageous from San Francisco writes, if I were the Chinese leadership, I'd seriously start planning just which method of surgical removal would work best on Kim. North Korea is virtually a welfare state, so naturally the Chinese are not all that anxious to inherit millions of extra mouths to feed on their dime. It's actually quite hilarious to see Kim in his specially made tiny elevated shoes beating his little flabby chest as though he and North Korea mattered to the world one way or another.
Well, some of our comments are amusing. South Korean people expressed mixed feelings Monday after prosecutors sought a 3-year prison term for former Korea Airlines executive Heather Cho, who, as you may recall, delayed a flight from the United States because she was not happy with the way that she was served nuts. Just for Kicks writes from parts unknown, he says, I have a nut allergy, so I won't be asking her out on a date.
Nor is she likely to accept.
Probably
Russia
not.
Clashed with Europe and the United States Tuesday over the aviation industry's response to the downing of Malaysia Airlines jetliner, calling for a delay in plans to establish a warning system on risks from conflict zones. John says, pro-Russian separatist rebels? You got to be kidding. There are 3/4 Russian mercenaries and 1/4 active Russian military personnel.
We've got a lot of stories on our website. Be sure to stop by voanews.com, and there you can comment on many of these stories, and we read some of them on the air. So we encourage you to write what you think and let us know.
We should also say that the comments that we read during that segment are certainly not necessarily the feeling of either us or the Voice of America.
Absolutely.
These are taken. They are unedited except for some grammar now and then. And you are going to hear some strong and opinionated conversation. Mm-hmm. And we will edit it if there is profanity or anything like that. But other than that, you're hearing it.
Read more. Go to the website, voanews.com.
The ways people in the West have viewed those in China have changed greatly over the past 150 years, thanks to the evolution of communication, photography, news, and movies. I'm Jim Stevenson with Authors on Asia. We open the book today with Sean Metzger, Assistant Professor of Performance Studies in the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television. He's also the author of Chinese Looks. From Q to the Qipao to the so-called Mao suit, Metzger explores how fashion has come to represent unique eras in U.S.-China relations.
One of the things that's been interesting to me is what kinds of new fashions are marking China today. So I think about things like the amount of Gucci you can purchase in Shanghai, for example. But I'm also curious about, for example, Captain America topped box office charts. And I think it's so ironic that an American superhero in the Stars and Stripes was suddenly doing so well at the Chinese box office. It seems like 30 years ago that would have been an absolute impossibility. So I'm curious to see what kind of new clothing people start to wear in China. And I would just return to one of the opening images in my book from 2005, a Newsweek cover with Zhang Ziyi, the actress, in a qipao-like top over a blue jean. And that kind of hybrid image, to me, anticipates Xi Jinping's drive for a new Chinese dream today.
Well, certainly over the past century, the qipao has really been an iconic dress that many of us can identify with as Chinese. And even to this day, in traditional weddings, it's used.
Yeah, that's right. And the qipao emerges in the 1920s and 1930s as a kind of equivalent to what men were wearing. So before the 1920s, men wore, as a traditional costume, a kind of long gown called chongkao. And that long gown was a contrast to what women were wearing, which was kind of a long tunic and loose pants. So as a kind of way to make women more equal to men, as women started to enter public discourse for the first time in China, they came up with this new dress, the qipao. And the qipao then, as time went on, became much more form-fitting. The hem went higher and higher and higher. So its original sort of political connotations became much more about women's sexuality, particularly in the Cold War period. And like many fashion trends, it fell out of favor.
So many of our stereotypes of the Chinese come from fashion and the dress and what we see in movies and film. And let's talk a little bit about the beginning of your book and the Q.
One of my readers actually had said the Q actually appears in lots of cultural productions that depict the end of the Qing dynasty. So anything that's set, you know, in from basically 1644 to 1911 in China is likely to depict Qs.
The Mao suit is quite an interesting entity of its own.
One of the interesting things that I found out when I was doing my research was that Mao's clothing varied quite a lot. But when the outfit started to register for the U.S. public and to some extent the European public, people consolidated the variation in clothing in under one term. So whatever people were wearing, they ended up calling it a Mao suit. So that could be like boiler suits for people working. It could be there are very famous depictions of Mao, you know, with his white shirt and his sleeves rolled up going to work. All of those things ended up getting called the Maoist uniform, even when the jacket wasn't present, which I found interesting. And again, there were variations throughout the communist period. So I think it's interesting that in the West, we have tended to say, oh, Maoist uniform is so much about conformity. But in fact, there's quite a lot of variation among the different outfits that people were wearing during the Cold War in China.
Sean Metzger, Assistant Professor of Performance Studies in the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television, and author of Chinese Looks, Fashion, Performance, Race. The book is published by Indiana University Press. I'm Jim Stevenson. We'll pull another volume from our bookshelves next week when you may hear more authors on Asia on VOA Global or anytime by visiting the voanews.com website.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. China cut the amount of money its banks must keep in reserve. It's a move aimed at prodding banks to make more loans to boost the country's weakening economy. The People's Bank of China said Wednesday it's dropping the reserve requirement for commercial lenders by half a percentage point, down to 19.5%. It trimmed the reserve figure a full percentage point for banks that lend for agriculture and hydroelectric projects favored by Beijing. The reserve cut immediately adds about $96 billion to the balance sheets of China's state banks. China's economy, the world's second largest behind the United States, advanced 7.4% last year. That was a substantially bigger gain than in the United States, Europe, and Japan. But it was the weakest increase in 24 years for China. On Sina Weibo, one comment said the central bank has done a great job this time in keeping the reduction a secret, considering today's stock market. Please keep up the good work and let people compete their capacity, not their information sources. Another comment said, I'm going to be rich. I love this. A power cable maker in the eastern Chinese city of Changzhou has reportedly won a contract to provide equipment for the country's second aircraft carrier, a development recorded Sunday on the official microblog of the Changzhou government and the state-owned Changzhou Evening News. The accounts were quickly deleted. The publication Asian Defense and Diplomacy says Google Maps satellite images indicate Beijing has constructed a model of the vessel in Wuhan province. It's about 300 meters long and 80 meters wide with a helicopter landing pad and models of carrier-borne aircraft. It says the mock-up may be used for testing of communication systems or possibly for military training exercises. China's first aircraft carrier, the 53,000-ton Liaoning, was purchased from Ukraine in 1998. It completed its maiden sea trials late last year in the disputed South China Sea, where one of its support vessels nearly collided with a U.S. Navy warship. Brad Glosserman, executive director of the Hawaii-based defense think tank Pacific Forum, told VOA's Victor Beatty, China's maritime intentions are clear.
The Chinese, I think, have long made clear their intentions to build a blue water navy, and an integral part of that navy would include aircraft carriers. And one of them that they purchased and refurbished from Ukraine is not sufficient. So at some point, and this has long been anticipated, not suspected, but expected, I think, is that China would begin to build its own. And this is the first hard evidence that that's actually taking place.
Well, the aircraft carrier, of course, as you know, is very technologically intricate, advanced. Does China have the capacity to build such carriers?
Getting in the water and making it float is one thing. Making it operate and shipshape is another. Then turning it into an effective aircraft carrier is a third and final thing. Several years ago, my organization hosted a meeting with Admiral Keating, who was at that time the head of the Pacific Command, and his comment to the Chinese as they were beginning the work on their first aircraft carrier that they'd purchased was, good luck. it's an extraordinarily difficult assignment to put an aircraft carrier and to put a carrier wing on it, to put the crews on it, and then to assemble the entire carrier battle group that goes with it. So building and making a ship seaworthy is almost the easiest part of the test.
China's defense spending has been skyrocketing in recent years. What is their long-term vision, defense policy, with regard to a blue water navy?
Well, to acquire one. I think the Chinese believe a couple of things. Number one, that they are, in fact, the rightful power of Asia, and that consequently, as part of that, the natural expression of that in some ways is a powerful navy. Second, there is the increasing acquisition of interests further and further afield, and the Chinese have become painfully aware that they are unable to defend those interests when they get far from China, and that they are uncomfortable, I think for some understandable reasons, relying on the United States for securing sea lanes. They're worried a great deal about vulnerability, particularly of energy supplies. Consequently, the Chinese see the acquisition of a blue water navy as just a natural outgrowth of its return to prominence within Asia and the world.
Brad Glosserman, executive director of the think tank Pacific Forum. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
We check Asia business from the Voice of America with Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. Japanese shares posted their biggest gains in more than 2 weeks Wednesday after Mitsubishi UFJ Financial Group's strong results lifted financial shares in hopes for a new Greek debt swap deal and a stabilization in oil prices underpin broader sentiment. The Nikkei share average ended 2% higher to 17,679. That's the biggest daily percentage gain since January. Hong Kong shares rose in line with most Asian markets, lifted by a rebound in the oil price and encouraging developments in Greece. The energy sector led gains in Hong Kong on Wednesday, sparked by the recent rally in oil prices. The Hang Seng Index rose half a percentage point to 24,680, while the China Enterprises Index was flat at 11,767. However, Chinese stocks closed down Wednesday, giving up morning gains as investors sold financial shares after China posted data showing its services sector grew at the slowest pace in 6 months in January. The Shanghai Composite Index lost 1% to 3174.
China saw a current account surplus, but a deficit in the capital and financial account for 2014, according to official data on Tuesday, which experts said reflected China's economic transition. For the whole of 2014, China had a current account surplus of about $214 billion and a $96 billion deficit in its capital and financial accounts. That's from the State Administration of Foreign Exchange, or SAFE, the country's foreign exchange regulator. In the fourth quarter of 2014, China posted a current account surplus of $61 billion, a $91 billion capital and financial account deficit. The country saw surpluses in both accounts in the final quarter of 2012. That's a look at Asia business news from VOA Global.
This is Today in History. On this day in 1788, British Prime Minister Sir Robert Peel was born. He issued a manifesto that is seen as the basis for the modern Conservative Party in Britain. He also founded the world's first professional police force. The men on patrol in London became known as Bobbies after Sir Robert. In 1885, Belgian King Leopold II established the Congo as his personal possession. What followed was a period of severe repression, even massacres of the local population by agents of the king. In 1908, amid growing international pressure, the Parliament of Belgium took the territory away from Leopold and turned it into the Belgian Congo. In 1917, after 7 years of revolution and civil upheaval, a constitutional Congress approved the modern Mexican Constitution. In 1917, the U.S. Congress overrode President Woodrow Wilson's veto of a bill curtailing the immigration of Asians to the U.S. In 2003, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell presented evidence to the U.N. Security Council that he said proved that Iraq was hiding a stockpile of weapons of mass destruction and that it intended to build nuclear weapons. Secretary Powell's evidence failed to persuade the council. 2 months later, the U.S. invaded Iraq but never found the weapons. The White House said it had received erroneous intelligence. On this day in 1940, Glenn Miller and his orchestra recorded one of the great classic songs of the big band era, Tuxedo Junction. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. In today's show, we'll have the latest on a deadly plane crash in Taiwan. We'll hear how Jordan's king is reacting to the Islamic State group's murder of a Jordanian pilot. And we'll tell you why the latest Ebola figures from West Africa are a setback for the region. Rescue workers in Taiwan have used a crane to lift part of the wreckage of a passenger plane that crashed outside of Taipei on Wednesday. The crash killed at least 25 people on board the plane and left nearly 20 others missing in shallow water. The TransAsia Airways ATR-72 clipped a bridge and plunged into the Keelung River shortly after takeoff. Rescuers in boats pulled at least 15 of the passengers to safety. The plane crashed just after taking off from Taipei's downtown Songshan Airport on its way to the outlying islands of Kinmen. It's not clear what caused the crash, which occurred during relatively clear weather. Jordan's King Abdullah has vowed to take tough action against Islamic State militants following the group's gruesome killing of a Jordanian pilot. The murder of pilot Muath al-Kasasbeh triggered international condemnation and prompted Jordanian authorities to execute two Iraqi prisoners, including failed suicide bomber Sajida al-Rishawi. In his remarks on Wednesday, King Abdullah said Jordan will be relentless in its war against Islamic State. A video emerged online Tuesday purporting to show the pilot locked inside a cage and then a militant lighting a trail of gasoline that traveled to the cage and burned him to death. He had been captured after his plane went down in December during a U.S.-led coalition mission targeting the militants in Syria. Libyan authorities say unidentified gunmen stormed a remote Libyan oil field late Tuesday, killing at least 12 people, including four foreign workers. The officials said Wednesday the victims include two workers from the Philippines and two from Ghana. They said some of the victims were shot, while others had their throats slashed. The Alma Brook oil field is about 160 kilometers south of the Libyan coastal city of Sirte. France's Total oil company is a partial owner of the facility, but it is operated by a Libyan firm. Egyptian judicial sources say a court has sentenced 230 activists to life in prison for taking part in clashes during Egypt's 2011 uprising against ousted President Hosni Mubarak. The sources said those sentenced to life in prison on Wednesday include a prominent secular Egyptian activist, Ahmed Duma. 30 other defendants, all minors, were given 10-year sentences. The case is connected to clashes between Egyptian protesters and security forces near Cairo's Tahrir Square in December 2011. Those clashes left more than 40 people dead. Turkey's banking regulators have seized control of an Islamic lender named Bank Asya, citing a lack of transparency in its operations. Some analysts see the Turkish government's seizure of the bank as the latest chapter in a bitter feud between Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and U.S.-based Turkish cleric Fethullah Gulen and his Hizmet movement. Dorian Jones has more on Bank Asya, which has denied any links to Gulen.
Bank Asya's woe started in December 2013, when the government and Mr. Erdogan were implicated in the high-level graft probe. Mr. Erdogan claimed the investigation was a coup attempt by Gulen followers. Since then, Bank Asya has faced growing pressure from state authorities and the pro-government media. Global Source Partners political consultant Attila Yeşillada says there is growing concern that bank seizure is part of a new trend.
I am already receiving questions from investors whom I serve about the political connections of major listed companies. This has become an issue. This is one of the main reasons why business and consumer confidence has been declining steadily for the last 5 months.
An international network of schools in more than 100 countries set up by Gulen is also in President Erdogan's sights. The school network developed across Africa is not only an important source of education, but also for commerce, which is why analyst Yeshalada says the Turkish president is determined to close them. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Nigerian militant group Boko Haram is reported to have killed dozens of people in a cross-border raid into Cameroon. A newspaper in Cameroon's far north region says Boko Haram fighters attacked the town of Fotokol early Wednesday and conducted what the paper calls a massacre. A resident of the town told VOA's French to Africa service that militants entered mosques and slit the throats of Muslims who had gathered for early morning prayers. Chad has taken the lead role in a multinational effort to help Nigeria to defeat Boko Haram and retake areas seized by the militants for an envisioned Islamic State. Somalia says a U.S. drone strike on Saturday killed its target, senior al-Shabaab militant leader Yusuf Deeg. The Somali government said in a statement Wednesday that Deeg was killed with other al-Shabaab commanders in the strike in the southern town of Dinsor. A source in the militant group confirmed Deeg's killing to VOA's Somali service. The number of reported Ebola cases has gone up for the first time this year in the three West African countries where the transmission is still active. The World Health Organization says 124 new cases were reported in the week ending February 1st, with a high of 80 new cases in Sierra Leone, followed by 39 in Guinea and 5 in Liberia. In its latest update released Wednesday, the World Health Organization said there is an urgent need to end the outbreak before the wet season begins and access to remote areas becomes more difficult. Zimbabwe's 90-year-old president, Robert Mugabe, fell down a staircase on Wednesday as he left the podium after a speech. There was no indication that Mr. Mugabe was hurt by the fall, and a presidential spokesman refused to discuss the incident with reporters. The president had just finished addressing supporters at Harare International Airport on his return from an African Union summit in Ethiopia, where he was elected African Union chairman. Witnesses said Mr. Mugabe missed a step and fell while walking down the stairs. The president was helped up to his feet by aides, who escorted him to a waiting car while dusting off his suit. Zimbabwean security agents quickly rounded up journalists covering the event and ordered them to delete all pictures of Mr. Mugabe's fall. Well, that's it for International Edition on The Voice of America. Join us again at 0330 Universal Time for an expanded look at the latest world news. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. If you'd like to reach me on Twitter, you can find me at Michael_Lippin, spelled L-I-P-I-N. Bye for now.
This is Business News on VOA Global with Ira Melman. I'm Jim Stevenson. A late-stage rebound in U.S. stocks was reversed, and indexes ended Wednesday's choppy session lower after the ECB said it was lifting a waiver on using Greek debt as collateral. The main benchmark spent most of the session in the red as a plunge in oil prices and less-than-stellar economic reports turned investors cautious. The Dow Jones Industrial Average erased a 110-point gain and finished marginally higher, up about 6 points to close at 17,673. The S&P 500 index down about 8 points, lower at 2041 overall, and the NASDAQ composite ended the day down 11 points at 4716.
The chief executive officer and five other executives of Brazil's state-controlled oil company, Petroleo SA, have resigned, capping a tumultuous period for a company mixed in debt and embroiled in a vast corruption scandal. That according to the Wall Street Journal. The chief executive, Maria das Graças Silva Foster, will step down effective immediately, according to the company, and Petrobras' board of directors will meet this Friday to choose replacements for her and the other five departing executives. Prosecutors in Brazil allege that several former Petrobras executives colluded with construction companies to overcharge Petrobras for work contracts and pocket millions of dollars for themselves.
Retail sales in the Eurozone rose for the third straight month in December and at the fastest annual pace in almost 8 years. It's an indication that falling oil prices are boosting consumer spending and also helping to support economic growth. Separate surveys of purchasing managers also released Wednesday showed that the Eurozone economy grew more rapidly than first estimated in January, driven by pickups in Germany, Spain, and Italy. France, though, was floundering. That's business news on VOA Global.
Well, we have a whole bunch of brand new, well, not brand new, they're 2015 BOA calendars. And
well,
I'm brand new
used.
Anymore. No, they haven't. Well, I've used a few of them. But nevertheless, we have a lot of them to give away and not a lot of time to
That's
give
right.
them away
That's
to
right.
you.
And we want you to have yours. If you have not already asked for a 2015 VOA calendar, please do so. Write to us at voaasia@voanews.com and include your full and correct postal mailing address.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. The United States has the largest prison population in the world, with more than 2 million people behind bars. In a growing number of prisons, inmates are doing more than just serving time. They're rearing endangered plants, animals, and butterflies for release in the wild. Tom Bonsi is here in the cafe with a story of how the concept is spreading across the country and even attracting interest from overseas.
Past two metal detectors and multiple guarded double gates topped with razor wire sits Washington State's Stafford Creek Prison Greenhouse Complex. There, a small crew wearing standard prison-issued khakis is sowing perennials. Months from now, these flowers will be transplanted to remnant prairies around Washington's Puget Sound to provide food for endangered butterflies.
These plants are so fickle.
Toby Earhart and his fellow inmates have plenty of time to nurture, experiment, and hone their craft on tray after tray of seedlings.
You cannot have a nursery that produces these for money because they would go broke or the cost would be so high that nobody could ever restore anything with them. So that's why this is such a good fit to have prisoners doing this because, well, I mean, they don't have to pay as much. So.
The convicted child rapist says his greenhouse work has made him more observant and conscientious. That's the sort of outcome prison superintendent Pat Glebe likes to see.
It helps with the level of violence in prison because these inmates all of a sudden they have something else to do and they see the value in it and they see the value of giving back.
Glebe says many people have a preconceived notion of what prison looks like. Then they tour his facility and can't help saying, wow. Stafford Creek's Prison Conservation Nursery has produced more than 1 million rare and endangered prairie plants since it opened 5 years ago. Inmates elsewhere are turning over a new leaf, too. At a state prison in Ohio, inmates are rearing endangered eastern hellbender salamanders for release in the wild. In Maryland, inmates do some of the heavy lifting to prepare bags of oyster shells used in restoration of the Chesapeake Bay. In Oregon, a voter-approved ballot measure has long required all inmates to work full-time or attend classes that tests prison managers to find meaningful work activity for everyone and further explains why Oregon's prison system was fertile ground to host conservation nurseries. A combination of federal, state, and private foundation grants cover most program costs. Tom Kay directs the Institute for Applied Ecology. That's one of the partners bringing money to the table in the Oregon Sustainability in Prisons project. He says, as you might expect, working in prisons presents some challenges.
Just going to visit and volunteer at a prison is no simple task. You have to watch your dress code. You have to watch how you behave in prisons.
But Kay says sticking with it is paying off handsomely on all sides.
Oh, the advantages far outweigh any of these disadvantages. Because we're able to get so much more done for ourselves in the mission that we are trying to accomplish.
And we have to settle it out to get the air out of it.
Participating inmates are paid a nominal rate for their labor, less than a dollar an hour in the Pacific Northwest. The gardening tasks sometimes appear tedious and repetitive.
A couple good scoops.
But that didn't stop inmate Joseph Jonge from applying for a transfer to the 2,000-bed Stafford Creek Prison specifically so he could compete for a job in the conservation nursery.
It's hard to get into the program, but when you get into the program, what they teach you is something that you probably won't get somewhere else, you know, because most of the seeds they're having us grow are endangered plants that you won't find anywhere else in the U.S. except here.
Washington's original environmental science program has branched out in many directions. At this prison, inmates also train shelter dogs to make them more adoptable. Other inmates are trying their hand at fish farming, yet other inmates refurbish bicycles and wheelchairs for the needy on the outside. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi near Aberdeen, Washington.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Have a seat and enjoy every day, anytime you want at voanews.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. A new film from the writers and directors of the Matrix trilogy, Jupiter Ascending, opens this month, with Mila Kunis, Eddie Redmayne, and Channing Tatum leading the cast. Jupiter Ascending tells the story of Jupiter Jones, a down-on-her-luck young woman who's cleaning houses in Chicago, who finds out she is actually one of the heirs to an interplanetary dynasty. Jupiter learns that Earth was actually seeded by an interstellar corporation 100,000 years ago. The corporation intends to harvest all of Earth's people when they have reached sufficient development in order to make a youth serum that enables the alien race to live forever. When the matriarch of one of the alien dynasties dies, there is a struggle for the inheritance. It turns out that Jupiter Jones is one of the heirs. At the film's premiere in Los Angeles, Mila Kunis said that she wanted to make a science fiction film, and she jumped at the opportunity to work with Lana and Andy Wachowski.
You know what? Channing and I wanted to do a film together, so that was that. And doing a sci-fi movie with the Wachowskis is something that I think everybody would love to do if they're a sci-fi nerd. So for me, I just got to geek out every day.
Channing Tatum plays Kane Wise, a genetically engineered hunter-soldier who comes to Earth to find Jupiter. Tatum says he has always loved science fiction.
I'm probably one of the biggest fans as I could possibly be. I mean, they really had a ginormous part of a very integral part of my life. So, it was an honor.
Oscar-nominated actor Eddie Redmayne plays the villain Bellum Brassix. He's the oldest heir of the alien dynasty and the one who wants to claim Earth as his own. He said at the premiere that working in front of a green screen was challenging, but he was pleased with the final product.
You know, I was a bit worried because I don't have a particularly good imagination myself. I was a bit like, you know, I knew a lot of it would be on green screen, and I was going, would I find that sort of inhibiting? And weirdly, I found it really sort of liberating. Lana and Andy would shout out directions from behind the camera, and I would just sort of run with it because it's a sort of leap of faith in some ways.
Sean Bean, who is known for his roles in The Lord of the Rings and HBO's Game of Thrones, plays Stinger Apini, a human bee hybrid who has been exiled to Earth. He said that the Wachowskis always bring something special to the screen.
When I first heard of it, it was the chance to work with the Wachowskis and having seen their work at The Matrix and Cloud Atlas and various other films, just their originality and their kind of that avant-garde kind of approach very much excites me. Yeah.
Lana Wachowski said at the premiere that she and her brother took inspiration from a couple of sources, including Homer's Odyssey and The Wizard of Oz.
And I was thinking how they were two stories that talked about home in relationship to identity and the way identity shifts and home remains this place where you return. And we were watching The Wizard of Oz, and I was thinking, God, I wish Dorothy was more affected by her journey. And that was kind of the idea.
Jupiter Ascending has received mixed reviews since its first showing at the Sundance Film Festival. Lana Wachowski says she's not surprised.
First screening of Matrix was a disaster. They told us to cut all the philosophy out of it. Speed Racer, we know about. Vendetta, they called us un-American at our first screening. You know, Cloud Atlas, we had literally a 12-minute standing ovation, but then the first review was worst movie ever made. You know, I mean, this is what we do. I think this is what originality does. It polarizes people.
Jupiter Ascending is rated PG-13 for science fiction, violence, and some suggestive content. It is distributed by Warner Brothers. So, are you a science fiction fan? Do you like Andy and Lana Wachowski's work? Let us know by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Ira Melman, and he's Jim Stevenson. You ever play Monopoly?
Oh, yeah. One of my favorite games.
It's worldwide. Now you can pass go. You can get out of jail free, but you can collect real money. Yeah, the French version of Monopoly is celebrating its 80th year, don't ask me, by slipping cash into 80 boxes of the game.
Wow.
Box will have a full complement of real money, 20,580 euros. Have fun.
You know...
Go what?
It's time for sports on VOA Global.
That it is.
With Ira Melman, I'm Jim Stevenson. You know, there were thousands of warmly dressed New England Patriots fans, some of them perched atop huge snow piles, cheering their team along Boston's frigid streets Wednesday to celebrate Sunday's Super Bowl victory with a downtown parade after two massive snowstorms. Early morning temperatures dropped to just 6 degrees Fahrenheit. That's minus 14 if you're keeping score on the Celsius scale. Fans packed into subway cars and commuter trains and arrived in high spirits, although a little less mobile due to their layers of warm clothing and Patriots jerseys. You can't forget those.
It's difficult to clap your hands when you have gloves on.
That's right. It was kind of a muffled clap, kind of like at the golf tournament.
Yeah, some sad news. Golf trailblazer Charlie Sippard was hailed as a legend by President Barack Obama and the grandpa that I never had by Tiger Woods as the golf world paused Wednesday to remember the first black man to join the PGA Tour. Sippard, who was well beyond his prime, went at the age of 38. He was accepted into the PGA in 1961, died Tuesday in Cleveland at the age of 92. Obama, who awarded Sippard the Presidential Medal of Freedom last year, termed Sippard a golf legend and exalted him for altering the course of the sport and the country he loved. Sippard had two PGA wins in 1967 and 69, though he enjoyed many other victories on the Small Money Black Players Tour prior to the PGA dropping its Caucasians-only policy.
Also in the sport, world number one golfer Rory McIlroy has settled his legal dispute with his former management company. The two sides said Wednesday that they had done just that, avoiding a potential 8 weeks in court. The world's media had descended on the Irish High Court on the Dublin's River Liffey in anticipation of seeing the four-time major winner take the stand in a case that he took time away from the golf course to prepare for last year.
Meanwhile, world number one women's tennis player Serena Williams has buried the hatchet and will return to Indian Wells to play in the tournament she's boycotted for 14 years after suffering racist abuse. In an interview with Time magazine, the Grand Slam singles champion said she had discovered the true meaning of forgiveness and she will play. There you have it, a look at sports from the Voice of America on VOA Global.
Mark Ronson's Uptown Funk featuring Bruno Mars is topping the Billboard Hot 100 for a fifth week. Funk was released on RCA Records. It's also spending a sixth week at the top of digital songs with 365,000 downloads. It sold up 7% in the week ending February 1st, according to Nielsen Music. And with its continued reign, Mars is rewriting his longest stay at the top of the chart. It passes Grenade, which spent 5 weeks at the top of digital songs in 2011.
Here now, Mark Ronson, featuring Bruno Mars with Uptown Funk.
This is that ice cold Michelle fight for that white gold. This one for them hood girls, them good girls, straight masterpieces. Styling, violin. Living it up in the city. Got Chucks on with Saint Laurent. Gotta kiss myself, I'm so pretty. I'm too hot. Call the police and the fireman. I'm too hot. Make a dragon wanna retire, man. I'm too hot. Say my name, you know who I am. I'm too hot. And my band bout that money. Break it down. Girls hit you, hallelujah. Girls hit you, hallelujah. Girls hit you, hallelujah. Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you. Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you. Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you. Saturday night and we in the spot. Don't believe me, just watch. Come
hallelujah. Girl, set you hallelujah. Girl, set you hallelujah. Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you.
Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you.
Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you.
Saturday night and we in the spot.
Don't believe me, just watch. Just watch. Don't believe me, just watch. Don't believe me, just watch. Hey, 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 oh!
Before we leave, let me tell y'all a little something. Uptown, funk you up. Uptown, funk you up. Uptown, funk you up. Uptown, funk you up. Jump on it. If you sexy, then flown it. If you freak, then own it. Don't beg about it, come show me. Come on, dance. Jump on it. If you sexy, then flown it.
Well, it's Saturday night and we in the spot. Don't believe it, just watch. Come on.
Uptown Funk here in the Voice of America. What a great dance tune.
Oh, yeah.
It's so good that some television news anchors on CNN Headline News the other day got on top of the desk, Robin Mead and her compatriots, and started dancing to
there
this
you go.
On the air,
that's
on top
TV.
Of their desk, all three of them. And that is a good dance song, and that's why it's been number one for as long as it has. That's music on the Voice of America. Well, we have a story about a man from Vermont, the U.S. state of Vermont, who sometimes was seen holding his coat together with safety pins, had a longtime habit of foraging for firewood, also had a knack for picking stocks. Talent that became public after his death when he bequeathed $6 million to his local library and hospital. The investments made by Ronald Reed, a former gas station employee and janitor who died in June at the age of 92, grew substantially over the years, according to his attorney. Reed, who was known for his flannel shirt and baseball cap, gave no hint of the size of his fortune. The lawyer said he was unbelievably frugal. When Reed visited her office, sometimes he parked so far away he wouldn't have to pay the meter.
Well, the bequest of $4.8 million to the Brattleboro Memorial Hospital and $1.2 million to the town's Brooks Memorial Library were, as you might guess, the largest each institution has ever received. Reed also made a number of smaller bequests. In addition to cash, he had an antique Edison phonograph. Hey, we'd like that.
Yes.
With dozens of recording drums that he left to the Dummerston Historical Society. That is really something.
I've already emailed my son.
He's up there.
He lives in Brattleboro, Vermont. And I said, go befriend some of the people at the hospital and the library and see if they want you to buy them a cup of coffee or something like that. So we shall see what happens. But stories like that are just fun.
Maybe more in a future show.
Yeah. Well, that's going to wrap things up for us for this day. Tracy Carter is our director. Zainab Abdelrahman has been our technical director. And our boss, our beloved boss, is Diane Gow. Thanks for being with us. Talk to you again tomorrow.
All right. Look forward to seeing you again.